Harper Audio presents The Daring Book for Girls by Andrea Buchanan and Miriam Peskowitz. Read by Ileana Kadushin. Copyright 2007 by Andrea J. Buchanan and Miriam Peskowitz. Production and abridgment copyright 2007 by HarperCollins Publishers. Introduction. We were girls in the days before the web, cell phones, or even voicemail. Telephones had cords and were dialed by, well, actually dialing. We listened to records and cassette tapes. We were practically grown-ups before CDs came to pass. And more often than not, we did daring things like walk to school by ourselves, ride our banana seat bikes to the local store, babysit when we were still young enough to be babysat ourselves, spend hours on our own playing hopscotch or tetherball, building a fort in our rooms, or turning our suburban neighborhood into the perfect setting for covert ops, impromptu ball games, and imaginary medieval kingdoms. Girls today are girls of the 21st century, with email accounts, digital cable, iPods, and complex video games. Their childhood is in many ways much cooler than ours. What we would have given for a remote control, a rock climbing wall, or video chatting. In other ways, though, girlhood today has become high-pressured and competitive, and girls are inducted into grown-uphood sooner, becoming tweens and teens and adult women before their time. In the face of all this pressure, we present stories and projects galore, drawn from the vastness of history, the wealth of girl knowledge, the breadth of sport, and the great outdoors. Consider The Daring Book for Girls a book of possibilities and ideas for filling a day with adventure, imagination, and fun. The world is bigger than you can imagine, and it's yours for the exploring, if you dare. Bon voyage. Andrea J. Buchanan, Miriam Peskowitz. Essential Gear. 1. Swiss Army Knife. A key tool for survival, exploring, and camping. It's a knife, screwdriver, and saw with tons of extras like a magnifying glass, nail file, bottle opener, scissors, and tweezers. Best of all, it fits in your pocket. Clean with hot soapy water and add a tiny drop of mechanical oil once every 3 blue moons. 2. Bandana. Can be used to keep your head cool, protect your treasure, wrap a present. Tied to a stick, it can carry your treasured possessions on your adventures. 3. Rope and twine. A stretch of rope and a knowledge of knots will take you many places, and may also help you get out of them. 4. Journal and pencil with a backup pen. Life is about memories. A quick sketch of a bird or a plant, a wish list, a jot of the most important thought ever. A pad and pencil is also perfect for spying or for writing the great American novel. 5. Hairband. For when hair gets in the way. In a pinch, you can also use your bandana or a pencil. 6. Bungee cord. For strapping things down on the go. 7. Flashlight. Basic tool for sleepouts and reading under the covers late at night. A small piece of red cellophane over the lens makes ghost stories even creepier. Eventually, you can graduate to a headlamp, so your hands are free. 8. Compass. You need to know where you are, and a compass can help. Hang it around your neck along with a whistle. 9. Safety pins. Because they're good to have on hand when things need to be put back together, or when you want to express eternal friendship to a new pal by decorating with a few beads as a gift. 10. Duct tape. 2 inches wide and hard as nails, It can fix almost everything. Good for clubhouse construction. 11. Deck of cards and a good book. Old standbys. 12. Patience. It's a quality and not a thing, but it's essential, so we'll include it here. Forget perfect on the first try. In the face of frustration, your best tool is a few deep breaths and remembering that you can do anything once you've practiced 200 times. Seriously. 14 games of tag. A game of tag can be as basic or as complicated as you like. You can revel in the pure straightforwardness of one person chasing another, or liven things up by adding rules and strategy. Either way, tag requires no equipment, no court, no uniform, just someone willing to be it, and others willing to run as fast as it takes to avoid getting tagged and becoming it themselves. Here are 14 ways of playing tag. 1. Blob tag / Chinese dragon tag. In blob tag or Chinese dragon tag, also known as chain tag, amoeba tag, and manhunt, one person is it. But instead of being able to tag someone and no longer be it, the person who is it tags a player, and each player who is tagged then has to link arms with the tagger and join in as it. As more players are tagged, the link of taggers grows, making it look like a blob of people or a Chinese dragon, hence the name. No tags count if the blob separates. The game is over when the last player is finally tagged. 2. Freeze tag. When a player is tagged in freeze tag, she must freeze in place immediately. Sometimes the game is played with the rule that other untagged players can unfreeze anyone who is frozen. The game can also be played so that the person who is it only wins when every single player is frozen. 3. Tornado tag. Also called hurricane tag, hurricane, and plain old tornado, this variation of tag requires the person who is it to spin around like a tornado with arms outstretched. If the person who is it tags someone without spinning, it doesn't count. 4. TV tag. In this version of tag, your generally useless TV knowledge comes in handy by saving you from becoming it. When a player is about to be tagged by the person who is it, she can keep herself safe by touching the ground and shouting out the name of a TV show. If a player can't think of a show title before being tagged, or if she says a title someone else has already used, that player becomes it. Another variation is to use movie titles or book titles. 5. Shadow tag. This game is perfect toward the end of a sunny day when shadows are long, since the main rule of shadow tag is that whoever is it can tag a player by stepping on her shadow. 6. Time warp tag. This kind of tag is played just like regular tag, except that at any point during the gameplay, any player, including whoever is it, can call out, "Time warp!" whereupon all players must move in slow motion. When time warp is called again, play returns to normal speed. 7. Line tag. In line tag, which is played best on a playground or other surface with lines or painted areas on it, players are allowed to run or walk only on the lines. These can be hopscotch lines, basketball court lines, or even lines on the sidewalk. If it's a line, you can step on it. Otherwise, you're out. If a player is tagged, she must sit down, and the only player who can move past her is the one who is it. 8. Zombie tag. The person who is it must chase after the players zombie style, staggering with her arms out in front of her and groaning like the undead. When the it zombie tags a player, that player also becomes a zombie. The game ends when all players have been transformed into moaning zombies. 9. Electric tag. When a player is tagged, complete with electric-sounding bzzz noises by person who is it, she must sit on the ground and become electrified which means that although she cannot stand up or move from her spot, she has the power of being it. The players who are not it and who have not been tagged must avoid being tagged by it and running too close to the electrified players, who are allowed to reach out and touch any player running past. Getting tagged by it or an electrified player means sitting down on the ground and becoming electrified yourself. The game continues until there is only one untagged, unelectrified player left. 10. Battle Tag. In this game, there are two players who are it, the freezer and the heater. Everyone else is a runner. The freezer and heater battle for control of the runners. The freezer wants everyone to be frozen, while the heater wants everyone to be unfrozen. The freezer freezes other players as in freeze tag, and the heater unfreezes frozen players. The heater cannot be frozen by the freezer, and the freezer cannot be melted by the heater. The freezer wins when all players are frozen before the heater can get to them. The heater wins when all players are unfrozen before the freezer can refreeze them. The game is over when everyone is too tired to run anymore. 11. Inverted Tag. For inverted tag, everything is backward. There is only one player who is not it, everyone else is it, and the object of the game is for everyone to chase the player who is not it and tag her. Whoever stays not it the longest is the winner. 12. Infection Tag. In Infection Tag, the player who is it infects everyone she tags, making every tagged player become it too. The last player tagged by any of the its becomes the first it for the next round of infection. 13. Hot Lava Monster Tag. This version of tag is similar to the game of Hot Lava, where certain areas of the ground are deemed hot lava, making them untouchable. In Hot Lava Monster Tag, which is best played on a playground, the entire ground is hot lava, and the hot lava monster, the person who is it, is the only person who can stand on it. Everyone else must move around on the play structures, being careful not to touch the ground. Any player who touches the ground or gets tagged by the hot lava monster becomes the new hot lava monster. 14. Hide and Seek Tag. This is best played in woods with lots of places to hide. Everyone who is not it runs off while the seeker closes her eyes and counts to 100 next to a designated tree. The seeker calls, "Ready or not, here I come," and begins searching for everyone else. The goal for those hiding is to get back to touch the tree before being tagged. Those who are tagged before touching the tree are also it and join the seeker. The last one to reach the tree or to be tagged is the seeker in the next game. Princesses Today. When most of us think of princesses, we conjure up fairy tales and Disney movies, lovely Cinderella or Belle in their pale blue taffeta and yellow silk ball gowns, or the ultra-pink princess merchandise pushed on girls today. Perhaps it's a surprise to find beneath the glitter that these are real people who are princesses, and who lead very different lives than we see in the sugary movies. Princesses who are comfortable wearing sensible wool suits and athletic clothes more often than fancy dresses and sparkly jewels. 39 nations in the world still have monarchies, constitutional monarchies, which means the royal family is important, but that the real political power is in the elected parliament and the prime minister. Many of these monarchies include princesses of all ages, some born into their royal family, like princesses Kako and Aiko of Japan, and some married in, like commoner princess Mette Marit of Norway. However they became princesses, these real girls and women are as different from one another as any girls can be. Many do live with great wealth and privilege, true, but their lives can be quite conventional. They go to school, start businesses, like Princess Naasi Okonzi of Ghana, who has had a TV home shopping show, and do charity work. Some are happy with their lives, and others struggle with their royal role, as did the late Diana, Princess of Wales, and the late Princess Leila of Iran. Real princesses have various personalities, talents, and hobbies. Princess Maha Shakri Surindhorn of Thailand writes poetry and short stories, plays Thai classical instruments, and also jogs, swims, bikes, and treks. A closer look at just six modern-day princesses gives you an idea of the many ways to live a real life of royalty today, and not one of these princesses resembles Sleeping Beauty. An equestrian princess. Her Royal Highness Haya Bint al-Hussein, also known as Princess Haya, was born in 1974 and grew up in the royal family of Jordan. Her father is the late King Hussein, and her mother is Queen Alia al-Hussein. She attended St. Hilda's College in Oxford, England, studying politics, philosophy, and economics. She is an avid sportswoman who competes in equestrian sports, horse competitions being a popular royal pastime, including the 2000 Summer Olympics at Sydney. In 2004, when she was 30, Princess Haya married His Highness Sheikh Mohammed, the Prime Minister and ruler of Dubai, and moved to that vibrant city in the United Arab Emirates to be with him. In her role as princess, Haya leads many humanitarian efforts. She advocates for children's rights to play and for health care, and she served as the first woman ambassador to the United Nations Hunger Relief Program. A champion fighter princess. Her Highness Sheikha Mehta bint Muhammad Al Maktoum has not traveled the standard princess and horses route. Born in 1980 to Sheikh Muhammad bin Rashid Al Maktoum of Dubai and the United Arab Emirates, Mehta has followed her passion for the martial arts and is a karate champion. Princess Mehta has won gold medals at Taekwondo championships, competes in international karate championships, and was named the Arab world's best female athlete. An every girl princess. Mary Elizabeth Donaldson fits the image of the ordinary girl who becomes a royal princess. Born in Australia in 1972, she grew up on the island of Tasmania, where her father was a math professor. She played field hockey and swam, and after graduation from college, she worked for an ad agency and in public relations. She met her future husband, Crown Prince Frederick of Denmark, at a pub in Sydney. He was in town for the 2000 Olympics. In 2004, they had a grand wedding, 800 guests at the Copenhagen Cathedral, and Mary Elizabeth became the new Princess of Denmark. They have since had two children, Prince Christian, born in 2005, and Princess Isabella, born in April 2007. An unassuming princess. Most people know that Prince Charles is the eldest son of Queen Elizabeth, the reigning Queen of England, and know of Charles's famous late wife, Diana. However, not as many people talk of Charles's only sister, Anne, which is just how she wants it. Anne was born in 1950, and her full title is Her Royal Highness, the Princess Anne Elizabeth, Princess Royal, which denotes that she is the eldest daughter of the Queen. Although she has not abdicated her royal status, she has led a very unassuming life outside the public eye. When she married, her first husband declined to take a royal title, even though it is considered common to do so. She chose not to pass on royal titles to her children, Peter and Zara, in order to protect them from the spotlight that hovers over children in the British royal family. A young lady princess. The youngest girl of the British royal line has also sidestepped the title princess. Born in 2003 to Prince Edward, Charles's younger brother, and his wife Sophie, who were also known as the Earl and Countess of Wessex, little Louise was given the title Lady instead. The princess title is still legally hers, and when she comes of age, she can fully adopt it if she wishes. A rediscovered princess. And here's one final princess story. That of Sarah Culberson, born in 1976. Her mother and father met in college in West Virginia, fell in love, and had Sarah, but they put her up for adoption just 2 days after she was born. When she was 22 and living in San Francisco, Sarah hired an investigator to find her birth parents. She learned that her mother, a native West Virginian, had died of cancer many years before, but that her father was a royal member of the Mende tribe in Bumpe, Sierra Leone. He was of the line of Paramount Chief, and as his long-lost daughter, Sarah was officially a princess. Now that she has claimed her title, Sarah's life as princess isn't about horses and galas. Sierra Leone had a devastatingly long civil war, and much of her family's village, including the school, is in shambles. Sarah has focused her efforts on raising money in the United States to send back to her tribe so they can rebuild their village and school. How to whistle with two fingers. Make a triangle with your pinkies by putting your pinky fingertips together, palms and fingers facing towards you. Stick out your tongue and put your pinky tips right on the center of it, pushing your tongue strongly against your fingers where they meet. Push your tongue back into your mouth with your fingers so that your pinky fingers are inside your mouth up to the first knuckles. Angle your pinky tips slightly down just behind your bottom teeth and keep your tongue pressing into your fingers. Purse your lips and blow. You may have to adjust the angle of your fingers to get that sound right, but just practice, and before you know it, you'll be hailing cabs with your piercing two-finger whistle. Tetherball. Tetherball requires a fast mind and equally fast hands to send the ball spiraling around the pole for a win. This was our favorite game growing up, and we'd love to see more tetherball courts, and maybe someday tetherball is an Olympic event. At its most basic, tetherball involves a ball, similar to a volleyball, but somewhat squishier, tied to the top of a 10-foot pole by a rope. Two players try to hit the ball in one direction so that the rope winds completely around the pole. But tetherball is also fun to play by yourself, in your backyard when no one's around. You can practice and make up games for yourself, too, like trying to duck before the ball hits you in the head. Actual tetherball courts have a circle drawn on the ground around the pole and are divided in half. A drawn circle isn't necessary, but you should expect to need about 8 to 10 feet of space all around the pole, and each player should stay on her own side of the circle. Rules. The rules of tetherball are deceptively simple. Two people stand opposite each other. One person serves by hitting the ball in one direction around the pole, and the other tries to hit the ball in the opposite direction around the pole. The first player to get the rope wrapped completely around the pole is the winner. Because the server has a big advantage, she gets to hit the ball first. Players can decide to play matches instead of single games. The total number of games comprising the entire match is up to the players to decide, but the winner must win by at least 2 games. Another way to decrease the serving advantage is to have the player who doesn't serve choose which side of the circle she is on and which direction she is hitting. Fouls and violations. How seriously you take fouls is something that needs to be decided before the game. Fouls include stepping across the center line, server hitting the ball twice at the beginning before the opponent hits it once, hitting the ball twice while it is still on your side of the circle, hitting the ball with any part of the body other than the hand or forearm, reaching around the pole and hitting the ball, catching or holding the ball, throwing the ball, touching the pole with any part of your body, hitting the rope with any part of your body. If you only have a few players, you can treat these fouls as mere violations and resume the game by stopping the ball and returning it to where it was wrapped when the violation occurred. The non-violating player gets to serve, and then either player can hit the ball. If a player racks up 3 violations, the opponent automatically wins. If the two players commit a violation at the same time, they must do a pole drop to start the game again. Both players hold the ball with one hand, lifting it about 3 feet away from the pole, directly over the line dividing their 2 halves of the circle, and then let go of the ball at the same time. The ball should hit the pole, and then either player can hit it to continue the game. No matter how you decide to play, the only absolute game ender is grabbing the pole. If a player does that, she immediately loses the game. Equipment. The ball. A tether ball is the only piece of equipment that you must purchase specifically for the game, and is similar to a volleyball, but softer. It will either have a loop sticking out of the surface, or a recessed spot on the surface of the ball to attach the rope. The pole. The best pole for the job is a 10 to 12 foot long, 2-inch diameter steel pipe sunk 2 feet into the ground, with an eye bolt run through the pole about 4 inches from the top for attaching the rope. This may be a good time to take a field trip to your local hardware store, but with a good eye, you might be able to spot a likely pole around town that will serve nicely for the game. Just remember to untie the ball and take it home with you when you are done. Making a tetherball court in your yard. Here is your shopping list. 10 to 12 foot long, 2-inch diameter steel pipe. 2 foot long, slightly wider than 2-inch diameter steel pipe. Eye bolt with nut for attaching the rope to the top of the pole. Drill and bit capable of drilling through metal. Concrete mix. Tether ball. Rope, if not included with the tether ball. Making the court. Drill a hole through the pole about 4 inches from the top for the eye bolt and put the eye bolt in place. Dig a hole in your lawn, gravel driveway, or backyard about 2.5 feet deep with a 2-foot diameter. Pour in 6 inches of concrete and let it set. Stand the 2-foot-long pipe in the hole and add concrete around the pipe to fill the hole. It's a good idea to have something to keep the pipe in place while the surrounding concrete sets. Also, the pipe should be level with the ground and should protrude just above ground level, but not so much that it sticks up enough to get nicked by a lawnmower. Once the concrete is set, slide the pole into your concrete and pole base. This should be a solid, tight fit, but the long pole is removable. Attach the rope and ball. Caring for your softball glove. A new glove is a beautiful thing, but the secret truth is that an already broken-in glove is a lot easier to play with, as the leather has already been softened. If you do have a new glove and need to break it in, don't worry. You can do it. It just takes a while. Start by putting it on your hand, and with the other hand, toss a softball at it, over and over. Use your glove daily. Play catch with a parent or friend. Play toss and catch against a solid brick wall or a pitchback. Walk up and down the street tossing a ball into your glove. Your goal in breaking in the glove is to soften the leather and create a pocket for the ball. Your glove is properly broken in when you close the mitt and the thumb and pinky come together and touch. Some people get kind of crazy about glove break-in. One time-honored suggestion involves putting the glove down on the street and running over it with a car. It's possible to bang at it with a rubber mallet, though make sure it's off your hand when you do. Some softball players store their glove with a ball in the pocket, held into place by a rubber band. Hardcore softball fanatics put the ball in the glove, wrap it very tightly with string, making sure the pinky side is tucked beneath the thumb side, and stow the whole package under the foot of their parents' mattress for a week or two. When the days get colder and the softball season is long gone, it's time to rub the smallest amount of conditioner into your glove. You can use official glove conditioning oil or home remedies like Vaseline or foam shaving cream. Just a little bit, really. Less is more when it comes to glove oil. Start at the bottom of the pocket and massage the oil toward the top. Find a cozy spot on the top shelf of your closet to store your glove until next softball season. Enjoy the winter. Playing cards. Hearts and gin. A short history. Early playing cards are believed to have originated in China, where paper was first invented, as a form of paper dominoes. The earliest references to playing cards in Europe, featuring decks with four suits, date from 1377. Cards back then were very expensive, as they were hand-painted and they looked quite different from the design of cards today. The earliest cards from China had designs recognizable to players of Mahjong, coins or circles, and bamboo or sticks. On their way from China to Europe, cards passed through the Islamic Empire, where they gained cups, swords, and court cards. Once in Europe, the generic court cards evolved into depictions of actual kings, knights, and other royalty, hence the name face cards. The Italian, Spanish, German, and Swiss cards did not include a queen, and in fact, even today, they still do not. The basic familiar design of the cards, with hearts, diamonds, spades, and clubs, and court cards of jacks, queens, and kings, came from France, and with the invention of woodcuts in the 14th century, mass production became possible, making the French cards popular all across Europe. Cards became popular in America as well, and Americans began refining card design around 1800. It was an American invention to create double-headed court cards so that the kings, queens, and jacks never needed to be turned upright, to index the cards by placing the number and suit in the corner for easy reference, to varnish the surface of the cards for easier shuffling and durability, and to round the corners, which always seemed to get bent over anyway. It was in America, too, that the Joker was born, as a part of a card game called Euchre, or sometimes Juker. The Joker became an opportunity for satire, depicting popular political figures as jesters or clowns, and for advertising, which savvy marketers had already plastered on the back of the cards. There are hundreds of games that can be played with cards. Here are two popular and fun games for four or two people, Hearts and Gin. Hearts. Hearts is a trick-taking game for four players, in which the object of the game is to avoid winning tricks, a set of cards, containing hearts or the Queen of Spades. Hearts began its life in Spain around 1750 in a game called Reverse, the point of which was to lose tricks, not gain them. Eventually, about 100 years later, Reverse fully morphed into the game we know today as Hearts. Tricks are rounds of play in which each player puts a card face up on the table, and the player with the highest card wins all the cards, also called trick-taking. But the real trick in this trick-taking game is that in Hearts, players want to avoid winning tricks, because the lowest score wins. Hearts uses a standard 52-card deck. Aces are high, and there is no trump suit. To start, the dealer deals the cards clockwise so that all the players have 13 cards each. Each player then chooses three cards to pass. On the first hand, the cards are passed to the left. On the next hand, the cards are passed right. On the third hand, cards are passed across. And on the fourth hand, no cards are passed. Cards are passed stacked face down, and players must choose and pass their cards to the correct player before they can look at the cards passed to them. The player who has the two of clubs goes first and must lead, or put down, that card. The play goes clockwise, with all the other players following suit, putting down a card of the same suit if possible. That means each player must put down a club's card. If a player doesn't have any clubs in this first hand, she can play any other card except for a heart or the Queen of Spades. The player with the highest card takes the trick, stacking the cards face down next to her, and starts the next round. After the first trick, a heart or the Queen of Spades can be used if a player doesn't have a card in the suit being led. Hearts can only be led, that is, be the first card in a trick, after a heart has been broken, played on a trick where a player couldn't follow suit. Play continues until all the cards have been played. Then you add up the points for each player. Each heart card gets one penalty point, and the Queen of Spades gets 13 penalty points. The game is over when at least one person has 100 points or more, and the winner is the player with the lowest score. But there is one last trick to be played in Hearts. A player can do something called shooting the moon. That is when one player takes all the point cards, all hearts and the queen. The player who does this has her points reduced to zero, and everyone else automatically gets 26 points added to their score. Gin Rummy. This two-player card game is said to have been created by a man named Elwood T. Baker, who was inspired by an 18th-century game called Whiskey Poker. Gin Rummy became popular in America in the 1930s, when Hollywood stars began playing the game in much the same way that celebrity poker is played today. To play the game, you need a standard 52-card deck and a pen and a pad of paper to keep score. You also need to know a bit of card talk to understand the game. To play. Decide who will be the dealer. The dealer then deals 10 cards to each of the two players and places the remaining cards in a stack between the players. Another card is placed face up, next to the deck, to create a discard pile. The goal of Gin is to try to get your 10 cards grouped in melds, sequences of cards, three or more cards of the same suit in order, or sets of cards, three or four cards of the same value. Before you take a turn, check to see if you have any melds or any groups of cards that could easily turn into melds. Each turn involves taking a card and discarding a card. The player who goes first draws a card from the deck. Now she must discard, choosing a card from her hand that is least likely to become a part of a meld. High point cards, like face cards, are good to discard if you can, since getting rid of them decreases your dead wood, the cards that are not part of any meld. Aces are low in this game. Face cards are worth 10 points each, aces are 1 point, and other cards are equal to their numerical values. A 2 card of any suit is worth 2 points, a 3 card is 3 points, etc. When a player discards, the card must be placed face up on the discard pile. The other player then has a turn, and she can draw from either the deck or the discard pile. Continue taking turns until a player knocks or until only 2 cards remain in the deck, in which case the hand ends in a draw. Knocking is when a player ends the round and is signaled by a player literally making a knocking sound on the table. A player can only knock if she has 10 points of deadwood or less. If you have 0 points of deadwood, also known as going gin, you must knock. Otherwise, you don't have to knock unless you want to. Even if you have 10 points in deadwood or less, you can keep playing to try for gin or for a lower point count. When you decide to knock, rap once on the table, lay down your cards face up, and add up your deadwood. The other player then lays down her hand and separates her deadwood from her melds. If she has any deadwood that could be incorporated into your melds, she can lay off. That is, give them to you for your meld so they cannot be counted as her deadwood. After that, add up her total remaining deadwood. Subtract your deadwood from the other player's deadwood, and the answer you get is your score for this hand. If you have 0 points of deadwood, you must knock and call gin. You get a 25-point bonus for gin on top of the points for the other player's deadwood, which she cannot lay off in this case. If you knock and it turns out the other player has less deadwood than you, you get no points, but the other player's score is not only the total of your deadwood minus hers, but 25 bonus points as well. That is called undercutting. After the cards have been counted and points totaled, gather up the cards, shuffle, and deal the next hand. Keep playing until one of the players reaches 100 points. Each player receives 25 points for each hand she won, and the player who reached 100 points first gets an extra 100-point bonus. The winner is the player with the most points after all the bonuses have been added. South Sea Islands. The South Sea Islands are rich with history, lore, and fantastical beauty, and are a tropical adventure paradise. One famous visitor to these remote islands was Pippolotta Delicatessa Windowshade Mackerel Mint Ephraim's Daughter Longstocking, otherwise known as Pippi, the spunky fictional heroine of the Pippi Longstocking books. In one adventure, red-haired Pippi's pirate father, the swashbuckling Ephraim Longstocking, capsizes his boat, the Hop Toad, on a South Sea isle, the fictional Kurikuridut. The locals pronounce him their leader, calling him Fat White Chief. And when Pippi comes to visit with her friends from Sweden, they call her Princess Pippolotta. Well, that was the 1940s. It has gone out of fashion to barge onto native islands like that, expecting to become the princess in chief in fiction or in reality. Today, were you to land on a South Sea island, whether because your own pirate ship takes water in the Pacific or because the tunnel you were digging from your backyard to China went slightly askew, here are some contemporary and historical details you'll want to know. Fascinating facts. The South Sea Islands are part of the geographical area called Oceania. This includes more than 10,000 islands in the Pacific Ocean. Some are mere specks of rock in the ocean. Others, like Hawaii, Australia, and New Zealand, are large and well-known. The islands are divided into four groups: Australasia, Micronesia, Melanesia, and Polynesia. Many of the islands are coral reefs, with villages built on the delicate skeletons of live coral. Some formed from the once hot lava of underwater volcanoes, which eventually rose to the water's surface. Additional islands are atolls. That's a narrow circle of land surrounded by ocean, with a lagoon in the middle. Atolls are the result of coral that has grown up on top of a volcanic island that over the years, and with changing water levels, has sunk back into the sea. Still others are archipelagos, long chains of islands scattered over an expanse of water. A good number of the islands are actually territories of faraway nations, like the United States, France, and the United Kingdom. A few, like Fiji, the Marshall Islands, Palau, and Vanuatu, are independent. Captain Cook's voyages to the South Seas. The famous English explorer, Captain James Cook, made three voyages through the Pacific Islands between 1768 and 1779. Cook was the first European to see Tahiti, to sail around New Zealand, and to set foot in Australia. A Tahitian man named Omai guided Cook through the islands during his first voyage. Cook brought Omai back to England with him, and on his third and final voyage to the islands, he returned Omai to his home. Cook left from Tahiti, heading north and then east to the Americas, where he mapped the west coast and tried unsuccessfully to find passage back to England through the Bering Strait. He died in Hawaii in 1779. Paul Gauguin and the South Pacific. Perhaps you have seen French artist Paul Gauguin's vivid paintings of village scenes, huts, and the spiritual life of South Sea Island people in his trademark Oranges and Lush Greens. Gauguin, 1848 to 1903, embraced these islands. On his last legs as a failed businessman, he left his Danish wife Meta and their five children, forcing them to live with Meta's family to make ends meet, and boarded a ship for the South Pacific. There he dreamt he could escape the conventions of European life and the impressionist school of art, which he found confining. In Tahiti and the Marquesas Islands, where Gauguin lived the rest of his days, he painted his now renowned images of island life. Gauguin found himself at odds with the European governments established on the islands. It turns out he couldn't really escape Europe after all. The colonial government sentenced him to prison, but he died of illness at the young age of 54, before he could serve his time. Gauguin is buried on the Marquesas Islands, and his work earned fame and fortune only after his death. War Battle on the Solomon Islands. During World War II, the key battle of Guadalcanal took place in the Solomon Islands. The Japanese were using several of the Solomon Islands as bases, hoping to intercept ships between the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. The Allies, the United States and its partners, wanted these islands for their own bases and to stop Japan's growing control in the South Pacific. From August 1942 to February 1943, United States Marines and Allied forces fought Japanese troops in and near the Solomon Islands. The Allies' victory at Guadalcanal was a major turning point in the war against Japan. Easter Island and the Moai Statues. Deep in the Pacific Ocean sits Rapa Nui, 2,000 miles from its nearest neighbors, Tahiti and Chile. Rapa Nui, also known as Easter Island, is famed for its haunting and huge human-like stone carvings, the Moai, who stood guard around the whole circle of the island's coast for 1,000 years. The first European to discover Easter Island was the Dutch explorer Admiral Roggeveen, who landed with his caravan of 3 ships, the Eagle, the Tienhoven, and the African Galley, on Easter Day in 1722, hence the island's English name. They were neither the first nor the last explorers to reach this outpost, as the Polynesians had been there since 400 AD, and other Europeans such as Captain Cook were on their way. Cook visited Rapa Nui, Easter Island, in 1774, on the second of his 3 voyages to the South Sea. He brought along the artist William Hodges, who was transfixed by the Moai statues and made oil paintings of them. A century later, several hundred villagers helped roll 2 of the Moai statues onto the British ship, HMS Topaz. The statues were brought back to England and presented to Queen Victoria. The Queen made a place for them in the British Museum, where in room 24 you can see them today. In 1888, Chile claimed Easter Island and transformed it into a giant sheep ranch. The Chilean colonists crowded the native islanders into the small village of Hengaroa and confined them with a stone wall, even taking some islanders as slaves. Life went from bad to worse. Some natives tried to escape the island in raft-like fishing boats, facing near certain death on the high seas. And the remaining statues? In the 1950s, Norwegian archaeologists docked at Easter Island, fascinated by reports and pictures of the mysterious Moai. Once again, the history of the South Sea Islands intersects with far-off Scandinavia. They found the Moai in sad disrepair. Invaders had taken some, and the rest had been pushed to the ground when missionaries converted the island to Christianity in the 1890s. Over time, the archaeologists restored nearly 250 of the Moai statues, some weighing several tons and standing 30 feet tall, hoisting them back onto their ancient stone platforms, each 1/2 mile from the next, where they circle the mysterious, stark, now treeless island once again and look out to sea. Exotic names for adventurous places. The South Sea Islands have amazing native names that paint mental pictures of this faraway world of ethereal beauty. Giao, Hatuti, Rapa Nui, Bora Bora, Makatea, and Tongal. Fanafuti, Olasega, Fatuhiva, Mangareva, and many more. Weather. Clouds. The terms for categorizing clouds were developed by Luke Howard, a London pharmacist and amateur meteorologist, in the early 1800s. Before this, clouds were merely described by how they appeared to the viewer. Gray, puffy, fleece, towers and castles, white, dark. Shortly before Howard came up with his cloud names, a few other weather scientists started devising cloud terminology of their own. But it was ultimately Howard's names, based on Latin descriptive terms, that stuck. Howard named 3 main types of clouds, cumulus, stratus, and cirrus. Clouds that carried precipitation he called nimbus, the Latin word for rain. Cumulus is Latin for heap or pile, so it makes sense that cumulus clouds are recognizable by their puffy, cotton ball-like appearance. These types of clouds are formed when warm and moist air is pushed upward, and their size depends on the force of that upward movement and the amount of water in the air. Cumulus clouds that are full of rain are called cumulonimbus. Stratus clouds are named for their layered, flat, stretched-out appearance, as stratus is the Latin word for layer. These clouds can look like a huge blanket across the sky. Cirrus clouds are named for their wispy, feathery look. Cirrus means curl of hair, and looking at cirrus clouds, you can see why Luke Howard thought to describe them that way. These clouds form only at high altitudes and are so thin that sunlight can pass all the way through them. Nimbus clouds, the rain clouds, can have any structure, or none at all. If you've seen the sky on a rainy day and it looks like one big giant gray cloud, you'll know what we mean. Weather vocabulary. Air pressure. Here's a fun fact. Air is actually a fluid. Like other fluids, it has internal pressure due to the force of Earth's gravity. Measured at sea level, the air weighs 14.7 pounds per square inch. Air pressure gets lower with increasing altitude. Alberta Clipper. A fast-moving snowstorm originating from the Canadian Rockies and moving quickly across the northern United States, bringing with it gusting winds and chilly Arctic air. Barometer. An instrument measuring atmospheric pressure, which can predict weather changes. Chinook. A type of warm, downslope wind in the Rocky Mountains, usually occurring after an intense cold spell and capable of making the temperature rise by as much as 40 degrees Fahrenheit in a matter of minutes. Humidity. The amount of moisture in the air. You've probably heard the expression, "It's not the heat, it's the humidity," meant to convey that the oppressive moisture in the air is what makes hot weather so uncomfortable. But even in the driest, hottest desert, there is always some water vapor in the air. There are two ways to measure humidity, absolute humidity and relative humidity. Absolute humidity is the percentage of moisture actually present in the air, while relative humidity is absolute humidity divided by the amount of water that could be present in the air. Relative humidity is what people are complaining about when they say, "It's not the heat, it's the humidity," because relative humidity indicates the amount of sweat that can evaporate from the skin. Mean temperature. The average of temperature readings taken over a specified amount of time. Wind. Wind is the air in natural motion, a current of air moving along or parallel to the ground. We can feel the wind and see the effects of wind, but we can't see the wind itself, except as it appears in meteorological pictures, as in the swirling spirals we see on weather maps when a hurricane is present. The way the wind blows depends on the atmosphere around it. In the presence of high and low pressure, the wind blows in a circular pattern, clockwise around a high-pressure cell, and counterclockwise around a low. Every girl's toolbox. With tools, you can make stuff, and that is a powerful feeling. You can help your grandfather finish that dollhouse he's been tinkering with for years. You can make a swing for the backyard, a bench for your clubhouse, or make the whole clubhouse. Experiment with wood, nails, screws, hammers, screwdrivers, and drills. After a while, you'll start to think in tools and materials, and you'll see how screws and nails hold wood together. Then you'll begin to come up with your own projects. Trial and error are the best teachers, and it doesn't take long to feel comfortable. Visiting the hardware store. Before we turn to the basic tools, a word on hardware stores. You might be intimidated by them, as many people are, especially those antiquated-looking small hardware stores with their dusty shelves filled to the brim with unfamiliar, scary-looking objects, usually guarded by men who are burly and possibly gruff. Fear not, we are here to tell you. Said hardware stores mark the entrance to a world in which you can create and repair anything imaginable. And the hardware store's burly guardians? The truth is, they may look gruff, but usually they're very nice, and they love to problem solve and to find the perfect nail or wire for you. Ask for help when you're matching bolts and nuts. Get their advice on what kind of drill bit will attach a wood plaque to the stone wall outside your house. They'll show you where to find Hardware Store Exotica, and they know fix-it secrets you'll never learn in books. Besides, many of them have daughters too, and you can bet they've taught their girls a thing or two about what to do with a hammer and a box of nails. Creating your toolbox. Every girl needs her own toolbox. You can get a decent toolbox with a latch and an organizing tray for as little as $10. Here are the basics to fill it with. 1. Safety glasses. These are an absolute must when hammering, drilling, or sawing. 2. Claw hammer. The flat side of the hammer bangs nails into wood. The V-shaped claw side pulls them out. To hammer, grip the handle solidly near the bottom. Hold a nail with your thumb and forefinger and tap it into the wood gently until it stands on its own. Then move your fingers away and hammer harder from your forearm. That is, don't use your entire arm, and keep your wrist straight. Keep your eye on the nail and trust your eye-hand coordination. 3. Nails. The measurements for nails derive from the British custom of selling 100 nails for a certain number of pennies. Nails are thus described in penny weights, except the resulting abbreviation is not P, but oddly enough D, in reference to an ancient Roman coin, the denarius. Once upon a time, you could walk into a store in Yorkshire and purchase 100 1.5-inch nails for 4 pence, and because of that, they are now labeled 4D nails. Much of the world, it must be said, uses the metric system for a more systematic and reasonable way to measure nails. 4. Screwdriver. The screwdriver not only gets screws where they're going and takes them out, it can be used in a bazillion creative ways to do almost anything. Try a 6-in-1 screwdriver, which has 6 changeable heads. To get jobs done faster, we recommend a battery-operated screwdriver.